Now, this is a part of the subject that the average religious church member is totally ignorant of. There are members of the churches in the Beaver Valley that are known as devout Christians that couldn't answer a set of questions on this to save themselves from the electric chair. It's a blank in most people's minds, and yet it's important because it gives you the connection between the Old Testament and the New. There was a very good chapter of 11 pages on this in Manley's New Bible Handbook that we used to use and couldn't get copies of and aren't using this year. Therefore, you are dependent on what's in the syllabus and what I'll give you in class today on this. Leon Wood's book doesn't go this far. Now, who can tell right off the top of your head what's the last book of the Old Testament? Mr. Thompson? Malachi. All right, one of the minor prophets, Malachi, and written about 400 before Christ. This is God's last word to the people of Israel until the coming of his son. It was followed by a 400-year silence. And then God began to speak again, having come in person in his son, Jesus Christ. Now, this is not found in books that the Protestant faith rates as canonical books. There are two books of Maccabees. These are rated by Protestants as part of the Apocrypha. They are late books written in Greek, originally not in Hebrew. They are found, however, among the canonical books of the Old Testament in the Catholic version, Catholic Bible, following St. Jerome, who got out the Vulgate. Now, this question of whether these books of Maccabees are canonical or not is not up for us to decide here. When we say, when Protestants say, these are not to be rated as part of the books of the Old Testament, this does not mean they're worthless. It only means they are not believed to be infallibly inspired and therefore, strictly speaking, part of the Word of God. And this belief is based upon some evidence that the Jews of Jesus' day regarded these books in a separate category, not the same as the 39 books that we had in the Old Testament. Now, leaving that, these books are partly historical and give valuable information about this period. And the other source that we have is a Jewish writer named Josephus. He lived around 100 after Christ and was, I guess, what today would be called a war correspondent. He followed the Roman armies around and wrote up the war. He was Jewish. He was not a Christian. He only has one mention in all his voluminous writings of Jesus Christ, and that's an obscure little sort of an incidental reference. So a non-Christian Jew, he was not liked by his own people. They considered him pro-Roman and therefore didn't like him. And on the other hand, the Romans liked him fine and gave him breaks that other people didn't have. He got passes to go places where other people couldn't go and so forth, so he got to be where the action was. And he wrote up a series of books on the history of the Jews. Part of it, simply a rewrite of what's in the Old Testament book, like we've been having in this course. But part of it covering this period between the Old Testament and the New. And therefore, this part is of prime importance to us in trying to figure out what happened in those 400 years. Now then, in the first place, we've had part of this already, the Persian period. 8 years, 539 to 331. Now, just two new things about this period. In the first place, the high priesthood became, in fact, a political office. You realize this was never intended to be. The first high priest was Aaron, the brother of Moses, and later his successors, of course, and this was intended to be strictly a religious office. With religious functions only. Every time in the Old Testament that a king tried to interfere with the functions of the priesthood, God did something about it. The first that attempted this was Saul, Samuel told him off and wrote him off. Wasn't anything to do with the message. Later, Uzziah, you recall, tried to burn incense on the altar of incense in the temple, and he was smitten with leprosy for this the rest of his life. After the high priest told him he had trespassed and was exceeding his proper function. Now you see, the priests and the prophets with them, of course, were the voice of God in the country. They are the conscience of a country and must be kept free from political manipulation or interference. They didn't have separation of church and state like we have it in America. The same bunch of people were the church and the state. But the functions of these offices were distinct. And the kings were a political office under God, of course, and everything, but still with political functions to carry out. And the priests and the prophets were religious offices. And so these were to be kept distinct. Now the high priesthood was a religious function. But in this Persian period, through nobody's fault in particular, it drifted into becoming a political function. And the reason for this was that the Jews were under these great empires, like the Persian, and later the Macedonian, and after that the Roman. Who speaks for the Jewish people? They don't have a king anymore. These emperors of these big empires, the government of these big empires, want to deal with the Jews that are one of the components of their empire. Who do you talk to? Who represents the Jews? Looked like nobody did. The nearest they had to somebody that represented them on a national scale was their high priest. Now he's supposed to be a religious officer, but that's all he got. So willingly, in spite of the ideology involved, the conquering empires began to consider the Jewish high priest as a sort of a spokesman for the whole Jewish people and a liaison man between the empire and the Jews, and so this acquired a political aspect which gradually overshadowed the religious. And so finally it came late in the period, down toward the time of the Romans, that the high priest would be appointed by these conquering empires, or if not appointed by them, confirmed by them. This is one thing. The other is the rise of the Sanhedrin, or Council of 70 Elders. This was not a legislative body. They didn't make new laws. They had the laws of God already, but it was a deliberative, an administrative body. This is the council that condemned Jesus to be crucified, and that had Stephen, the first Christian martyr, stoned to death. And that tried to kill the Apostle Paul, but they didn't succeed in doing that. Now then, the next thing is the Macedonian and Greek period. All the part of this history that we've had up till now, the center of things has been in southwestern Asia. Trace it on down. The Hittites, the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Persians, the Medes. Now the center of action shifts to Europe, and a European, Alexander the Great, takes the spotlight, and world politics gets a major shift of gears. All right, Alexander, if he were living today, would be called a Greek. He was a Macedonian. This is part of Greece today. The language in his time was slightly different from the Greek spoken at Athens, for example. However, Macedonia in Alexander's day was not considered part of Greece. The Greeks in Greece itself thought of this as a sort of a subculture, that it wasn't just up to standard. It's sort of the wild and woolly north and up on the frontier there. And they had looked down on them a little bit. Now, Alexander's father was Philip, king of Macedon, and his mother's name was Mrs. Philip. She had a name, but I don't know what it was. And these two were incompatibility incorporated. Now, you know, a married couple is generally supposed to live together. That's a pretty old human custom. But here, Alexander's father and his mother hated each other so that they not only wouldn't live in the same house, a good deal of time they wouldn't live in the same town. That's what I call real incompatibility. You won't even live in the same town. And when they did live together, they fought and quarreled all the time. This caused Alexander, when he was a child, to grow up simply packed with suppressed resentment. Now I wonder, Miss Hudson, is it good for kids to grow up with their father and mother scrapping all the time? Can children sense this, that their parents aren't getting along? Well, you bet they can. They can tell, even if there isn't a word spoken, you know? Cold war in the home, this icy politeness between father and mother, is worse than one of them hitting the other with a rolling pin. This is more cruel, mental cruelty, and kids can sense it. You don't have to tell them. They don't have to be instructed about it. They can tell whether their father and mother love each other or not. Well, Alexander's parents didn't. And Alexander grew up bitterly resentful, just packed with hostilities on account of this. But of course, what could he do about it? He was only a child. Later, when his father died and he came to power in his own right, he started to do things. Now look, first place, packed with suppressed resentment. He got a paper for psychology on what made this so-called tick. Secondly, he had military genius such as only a handful of men have had since the world began. This man ranks as a military genius with Julius Caesar, Napoleon Bonaparte, and very few others. And thirdly, he was a king back in the time when kings were kings and had real power. So here's resentment plus genius plus power. Add them up. He was a menace to the world. And he drenched the world in blood to satisfy his pent-up hostilities and his greedy, selfish ambition. All right, first Alexander got the Greeks united under his flag. First time in their long history they've been truly united under a single government. Then he went and conquered the Persian Empire. Now the Persians had tried and tried and tried and tried to conquer the Greeks and never succeeded. Finally had to give it up for a bad job, and the Greeks fought very nobly for their freedom. They didn't want to be ruled by the Persians. And they won. And the Persians gave it up. And now, finally, a European, whom we would call a Greek, turns the tables on them and attacks them. 13 years of war. And the Persian Empire toppled like a tree that's been cut down. Persepolis, its beautiful capital, wondrous part of the ancient world, was burned by Alexander. He put the torch to it and burned it. And the histories that have come down from ancient times say that he did this to please one of his lady friends, to whom he was not exactly married, who said she hadn't seen a real good fire for quite a spell. And he burned Persepolis to please her. Now, modern historians doubt this story, but there's no doubt he burned Persepolis. The part about the lady friend is what they got. But anyhow, he burned Persepolis, and the Persian Empire was in his hands. The biggest empire the world had ever known, this was bigger than the Persian had been. It went from Pakistan to Sudan, south of Egypt, and it included Greece and part of the Balkan Peninsula that the Persian Empire had never included. Tremendous sprawling bunch of piece of territory. Now, Alexander got as far as northern India, and his soldiers mutinied and refused to go further. It looked like Asia was pretty terribly big, and they were pretty homesick for Greece, wanted to go home, and they refused to go further. Alexander was a very melodramatic stage actor, and is said to have pulled out his handkerchief and wept tears because there were no more worlds to conquer. I don't know if that's literally true, but that's kind of the fellow he was. And so he had to go back. And his army finally got back to Greece. There is also an amazing thing about this. He had a fleet anchored in the Persian Gulf, a ship with sailors and soldiers on it. And this fleet mysteriously disappeared and was never heard from again. Whatever happened? Was it completely and without a single life saved, lost by a storm at sea, or what happened to it? And what I'll tell you next, I'm not putting out for gospel truth, but it's intrigued me. I read in a book in our McCartney library, there is a theory that Alexander's missing fleet got blown across the Pacific Ocean to Mexico, and that there are fissures in the pyramids and temples of the Aztecs and the Mayans of the prehistoric pre-Columbus Mexico that resemble some things in Greece and in Egypt, and that these people on Alexander's fleet, several hundred of them, formed one, let's say, factor of the racial stock of pre-Columbus Central America. This is not proved, but there's some evidence for it, and if it isn't true, okay, what happened to Alexander's fleet, you see? So it's an interesting subject. Maybe one of you will become famous by researching this someday. Now, Alexander got back as far as Babylon. I'll tell you what happened to him in a minute, but one story about him here. He got drunk at a party. He got very drunk and got in a quarrel with one of his main staff officers. This man, one of his most loyal and competent supporters. And Alexander got in a drunken quarrel with him and pulled out a dagger and stabbed him dead. And this officer fell on the ground, bleeding and dying. And this sobered Alexander. He said, "What have I done? What have I done?" This man was the last of the family in Greece. His three older brothers have all died fighting my war. He's the only one left. And his old father back in Greece is waiting for this one to come home, and now I have killed him. What will I do? And what will the father say when he hears this? He must never hear it. So he dispatched a messenger to Greece to kill the father before the news could reach him. Now this story, there are some historians about this one too, but it comes down from Plutarch's Lives, I believe, written not too long after Alexander's time. Now, at Babylon, he took sick. Probably partly a result of his very heavy drinking and partying, which perhaps lowered his resistance to infection. He got a high fever, and medical researchers are trying to figure out what was it that got Alexander. Whatever it was, he didn't last long. He had a raging fever, and in a few days, he was dead. At the age of 33, Jesus Christ and Alexander both met death at the age of 33. And both left an imprint on world history that will always remain, of course. But what a different imprint. Alexander, a young man with the prospect of life before him, drenched the world in blood to work off his own hostilities and ambitions. And Jesus, also 33, voluntarily sacrificed his life out of love to save others. Now, this tremendous empire of Alexander, after he was dead, there was nobody that had the political ability, let's say, and know-how to hold this together and administer. So his main generals decided to divide it up. And they broke it up into four main units plus some littler pieces. And and then they ruled over these. So here's one empire became four smaller empires. Of these, only two concern us here. The other two, learn about the humanities course if you're interested in that much. Only two. One of these, now these are Greek dynasties, ruled over by the successors of Alexander. These are breakup parts of Alexander's empire. One of these, a Greek dynasty based at Alexandria, Egypt, and their name was the Ptolemies. Now, if you're Greek, I think you pronounce that with a P, Ptolemy. And if you want a mnemonic, the Ptolemies were tolerant. Or maybe I should say Ptolemy. The Ptolemies were tolerant. These people represented Greek culture at its best. Education, philosophy, athletics, freedom, respect for human dignity. This is the Ptolemies. It was one of them, Ptolemy Philadelphus, Ptolemy the lover of brotherhood, that got the Jewish scriptures translated into Greek. He wanted it for his collection, but this financed the translation of the Jewish Old Testament into the Greek language, the LXX or Septuagint, extremely influential. Ptolemy the lover of brotherhood. He wasn't a believer in the God of the Jews, but he had some human values, you see. And we know what he looked like. There are coins that have survived with his picture on it. Not a bad looking guy either. That's Ptolemy Philadelphus. Now the Jews were first under the Ptolemy dynasty. And as long as they were under them, they got along fine. The Ptolemies did not try to change anybody's religion or force anything on people. And so the Jews had a high degree of freedom about their internal affairs while they were under the Ptolemy dynasty. But then up north on the other side of the Jews, in northern Syria, was the Seleucid dynasty, S-E-L-E-U-C-I-D, also Greek. At Antioch in Syria, these people were just the opposite of the Ptolemies. If the Ptolemies were Greek culture at its best, the Seleucids were Greek culture at its worst. Tyrannical, totalitarian, cruel, oppressive, and insisting on a level of uniformity among the people of their conquered empire. Everybody is going to believe alike, get educated alike, dress alike, talk alike, read and write alike, perform athletics alike, and worship alike. And they're going to buy Greek culture on this uniform mass scale. And if they don't, you can always try to ram it down their throat. And if this doesn't work, you can still always cut their head off. This is the solution, the perfectly terrible, tyrannical program. Now, the Seleucids and the Ptolemies fought back and forth. This is what is predicted in the 11th chapter of Daniel. Only here today we're dealing not with a prediction, but with the history. They fought back and forth for quite a while. Finally, the Seleucids won. And the Jews, from having been under the Ptolemies, passed to be under the Seleucids. And then their troubles began. Now, there came to be a Seleucid king. He was a Syrian Greek from the bishop of Alexander's empire, right up here from Westley, Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus was this fellow's name. Epiphanes was an honorary degree that he conferred on himself. It means brilliant. I heard somebody say, you know, the honorary doctor's affinity degree, D.D., the qualifications for this are the 5 B's. All, bifocal, squid, dog, and bunny. Well, an honorary D.D. doesn't always mean very much. And this man conferred this honorary degree on himself, and it means the brilliant, the radiant, the bright, shining one, the insurgent. Now, if you've read history, you've heard of Louis the Pious and Charles the Bald and Henry the Fat and so on. So here's Antiochus the Brilliant. Only this is what he called himself. Now, in Greek, this TH here, pronounced like our S, is a single letter, this letter 5 over here. And this word is not pronounced Epiphanes in Greek, it's pronounced Epiphanes. And they would have big parades, and thousands of people had to turn out and march and cheer for him and shout Epiphanes, the brilliant one, as he would go past. But a lot of his subjects didn't like him that well and didn't take him that seriously, and so they had a slim iron curtain type joke on him. There would be maybe 10 or 12,000 people in a parade, a demonstration, and they're supposed to shout Epiphanes. But half of them shouted Epimanes. That only differs by one letter, but it means the crazy man. You can see the root of the word maniac in there. So Antiochus, not the brilliant, but the maniac.
But his Antiochus the Nut. This is what a lot of his people thought of him. Now, maybe he really was. Maybe if Antiochus were living today, he would be diagnosed as having paranoia, something like this. I don't know. If you don't think so, maybe. You know, the Greeks didn't have the Greek tradition of how to win friends and influence people. But just as a general principle, I don't think you win friends by kicking people in the stomach and then sitting on their head. This is not likely to win you many friends. And while in fact it didn't exactly do that literally, what he did was present and his welcome was that, and even worse. This man had this crazy idea that you could force people to believe a lie. And that you could force people to accept the Greek culture. There was a Japanese officer in Korea before World War II said, the Koreans are going to love Japan, and if they don't, we're going to shoot them until they do. But how many bullets does that take to make you love a country that has destroyed everything you hold dear? Now, this was Antiochus. He tried to force everybody in his dominions to adopt the Greek pattern. As they understood it, this was the Greek pattern at its worst, not at its best. And most of the people of the ancient Near East had long before learned that the way to live through a thing like this is to compromise. The grass that bends doesn't get broken when you step on it, you see. But the Jews wouldn't. They had suffered too much for their faith, and they aren't going to compromise. Now, then, Antiochus, he must have studied the Jewish religion and found out exactly what it was that they couldn't do. He started by forced them to adopt the Greek pattern of life and lifestyle, and they wouldn't do it. He started by putting up an image of Zeus or Jupiter in the temple at Jerusalem. An image of Jupiter or Zeus. Now, every Jew in the world, let me tell you, even the ones that weren't very religious, would have cheerfully died to prevent that happening. But there was nothing they could do. Next, he evidently researched the Jewish faith, and he found out that some things were rated as unclean. And in particular, pork, the hog, the pig, is an unclean animal. So he sacrificed a sow, a female pig, on the altar of burnt offering in the temple of the Lord in Jerusalem. This most horrible sense from the Jewish standpoint. Then he had about 10 gallons of pork gravy cooked up and sprayed the walls of the temple, inside, all over the place, with pork gravy. This is what I said. This is kicking them in the stomach and sitting on their head. This is a deliberate insult and attempt to outrage the Jews. Now he went further than that. The rite of circumcision, ordered to be performed on Jewish boy babies at the age of 8, according to 8 days, was forbidden by law. And where this had been carried out in obedience to the law of God, the babies were strapped on their mother's back and the mother and baby together thrown over a high cliff to their death. Another form of torture they had was to put somebody that wouldn't worship the Greek gods in a big cauldron of oil and gradually heat it until it was nearly boiling and they died. Josephus records the story of a woman with 7 grown sons. And they were arrested and given this boiling oil treatment, and she stood by, and each one in turn exhorted them not to deny their faith, and not one of them did. They all died as martyrs, and finally the Seleucids killed her too, the same way. Now, this was what the Jews were suffering because of their faith, because they wouldn't compromise. There was nothing they could do, but inside they were simply just filled with rage and outrage over this kind of treatment, so unjust and so wicked. But they had no soldiers. It was over 400 years since Jews had been soldiers. The last time was 586, when poor old King Zedekiah was blinded and led off to prison. Count it down. 586 to 486, 386, 286, 186 is 400 years and a little over. since Jews had been soldiers. They had no military training, they had no weapons, so they were helpless in the face of this ruthless persecution. Now there's a little form, and you see, I read an article in a magazine titled "Oppression is a Time Bomb." The authors tried to show this, that when oppression goes on in human history, the longer it continues before relief comes, the bigger the blow-up when it finally does come. Maybe the French Revolution of the end of the 1700s is an example of that. Conditions have been so bad for so long that when it finally came, France got a bloodbath they've hardly recovered from yet. All right, oppression is a time bomb. The Jews were building up dynamite inside of themselves, and all it was going to take was a spark to blow everything sky high. There's a little town near Jerusalem called Modin, M-O-D-I-N. It might have been called Podunk, and it would have been a Podunk and never remembered in history except for what happened there on this one certain day at Modin. Here, a Seleucid officer from Antioch of this early Greek dynasty had set up an altar and was trying to force a Jew to offer sacrifice and perform religious worship at this altar. And this Jew was doing it, said his own skin, of course. And a great crowd of people around watching this scene. And among these was an elderly Jewish priest named Mattathias, who was terribly disturbed about what was going on. And suddenly something inside of him clicked, and he figured, that's it, I've had it, and I can't take any more. And he whipped around with lightning speed and grasped the sword out of the hand of that Seleucid officer and turned around and killed him with it just like that in just a couple of seconds. Then he turned around and killed the Jew that had been offering this sacrifice. And everybody, you know, standing there just simply gasping at this sudden turn of events. And Mattathias held up this bloody dripping sword and waved it around over his head and shouted, "Whoever is zealous for the law and the covenants, let him follow me." That was ringing the Liberty Bell on the Seleucids. And with his five grown sons, he headed for the hills. Now, it wasn't very long till Mattathias said, considerable army there. You know, everybody was just ready for this. All that happened, it was just going to take a spark to blow things up. Just somebody run the flag up on the flagpole and people would rally to it. So he soon had an army of people that couldn't take it anymore. People get so they don't care whether they get killed or not. They were armed with kitchen knives, shovels, pitchforks, axes, potato mashers, anything you could think of. But they had one thing that is a tremendous help in war. They believed in their cause. These men are fighting for their families, for their religion, and for their liberty, their freedom. Now, the Seleucids were understandably angry at what had happened. They came back to punish these people at Modin that had done this, but they couldn't find them. And Mattathias and his followers, they were on their home ground. They know every little lane and path through the woods and so forth. And they fight a guerrilla warfare. The Seleucids, Syrian Greek soldiers, on the other hand, fight according to textbooks of military science. They come marching in, you know, left, right, company, halt, everything going according to the book. And they complain that the followers of Mattathias didn't fight fair, according to the rules. Well, that didn't make any difference. Now, Mattathias and his followers would ambush a Seleucid Syrian Greek company of soldiers, kill them all, and take all their weapons. Other times, 500 of Mattathias' followers would surround a Seleucid garrison that had 50 men in it, maybe, kill them all, and take all their weapons, and so they soon began to have better weapons. And they began to win. The Seleucids, however, found out there was one day a week that the Jews wouldn't fight. This was their Sabbath. You see, they were really super strict about this. And so the solicitors began to specialize on Sabbath morning surprise parties. And for a couple of three times, the Jews were simply butchered in cold blood because they thought it was sinful to resist. In fact, even the defensive action, you see, on the Sabbath. Now, Mattathias died, and Paul was taken over by one of his five sons, Judas Maccabeus. Some question about the meaning of this name, but commonly taken to mean Judas the Hammer. You can recall your last football game, and you know one of our cheers, hit him again, harder. That's Judas Maccabeus for you. Judas the Hammer. And here he led the Jews to victory. After they had walked terribly on three or four successive Sabbath mornings, the Ash Saturday, you see, Judas got the leaders of the Jews together and said, "Look here, men, we've absolutely got to rethink this business of fighting on the Sabbath. I believe in the Sabbath the same as you do. And we won't attack them on the Sabbath, but if they attack us, I, for one, don't believe that God wants us to simply lie down and be killed. I think we ought to fight back." Now, you know, he was on solid ground. Who can remember how many days in succession the Israelites marched around Jericho? How many was it? Huh? How many did you say? Seven. All right, 7 days in succession. One of those must have been the Sabbath, is that right? By command of God. That wasn't even defensive warfare, that was aggressive warfare. 7 days in succession, one of them must have been the Sabbath. Now, I suppose that probably some of you are pretty strict about the Sabbath too, but if you get up on Sunday morning and find your house is on fire, would you say, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. I'm going to Sunday school and church and young people from church again tomorrow. I'll call the fire department. I don't think you would. And if you did, I think you'd say, there are some emergency situations where the ordinary rules don't apply. Now, Judas taught the Jews to fight back, not to start a fight, but to fight back on the Sabbath. The next time the Seleucid soldiers pulled a Sabbath morning surprise party, they got the surprise of their lives. The Jews won. And the next week, the Jews won again. And the week after that, they won again. And by this time, the Seleucid sort of got over their preference for the Sabbath day as a day for fighting battle. Now, the Jews won back their whole country. There's a map in your book of Bible maps, that Hammond's Bible Atlas, that shows in different tints the stages by which they got it back. They got Jerusalem back, and they had elaborate religious rites to purify the temple of all that desecration, all gravy and everything. And finally, they got their whole country back. They were still nominally part of the Seleucid Empire, sort of a tissue paper connection, but in real point of fact, they were independent and free again. Now, it would be very nice if we could stop at this point and say they lived happily ever after, like they do in fairy tales. Life isn't like that, though, and the sad truth is that the Jews, after fighting so nobly and heroically, side by side and shoulder to shoulder for their freedom, when they had finally won their freedom and had peace, they began to fight each other. There arose two parties among the Jews, which you find very prominently mentioned in the New Testament, the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Now, the Pharisees were isolationists. The name means separatists. This party favored, clinging tightly to everything Jewish against everything that was not Jewish. They were rightists and conservatives and wanted to cling tightly to everything Jewish and react against everything that wasn't Jewish. The Sadducees were their opponents among the Jews. This party favored adjustment or, accommodation to Greek culture, including Greek philosophy, athletics, and the rest of the whole thing. Now, the Sadducees were greatly influenced by Greek philosophy, including the religious skepticism that went with it. Some of them didn't even believe in God. None of them believed in the resurrection or life after death or in heaven. That's how he was living. I heard a lady in a Beaver Falls church say the Sadducees did not believe in future life or heaven or the resurrection. They were sad, you see. Now, that's the derivation of the word. It's a pretty good mnemonic, though. The word comes from Zadok. It's the Greek spelling of the Zadok party. These people were rationalists. They were really unbelievers, but they had all the high-paying positions in the temple and everything lined up on their side. And so the Jews, after winning their freedom, they began to fight between the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And there arose a high priest, Alexander Janneus, the successor of Judas Maccabeus. Probably this man, Alexander Janneus, was the wicked priest, mentioned but not named. He was only called the wicked priest in the Dead Sea Scrolls. He was a terrible person. He had 800 Pharisees crucified all at one time because they belonged to the wrong political party. Now, I remember when Dwight Eisenhower defeated Adlai Stevenson in an election to be president of the United States. And a woman in Moscow said to an American news correspondent, "Poor Mr. Stevenson, I suppose now he will be shot." Now, maybe we've made progress since then. We shoot people now before they get to lose the election and not after. But I still hope you can lose an election without being shot. But back at that time, to be of the wrong party, you might get crucified. All right, the Jews fighting a civil war among themselves, tragic beyond belief. And out on the edge, there's a big rising new empire of the Romans. And they considered let's say a Bush League war on the frontier of their empire, a standing invitation for them to come in and settle it, and then, of course, take a place over. So Pompey, contemporary of Julius Caesar, 63 B.C., moved in to stop the Jews fighting each other. He said it was a threat to world peace. I don't know whether it was or not, but that's what he thought. He landed and marched on Jerusalem and captured the city of